Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Hey, Nick. Welcome to 10% True. Thanks for joining us on the show.
It's my pleasure. I've enjoyed so many of the other shows that you've had and enjoyed listening to the other guests you've interviewed that I'm honoured to be here, quite frankly.
It's great to have a fellow Brit on the show after a fairly long run of US-centric content. And as people can see from our backgrounds, today we're going to talk about the Tornado and your service as an RAF fastjet pilot. But I'm hoping it's going to be a wide-ranging interview that takes in not only your time on the Tornado, but also your journey through the fastjet training pipeline. So on that note, why don't we start at the beginning? Perhaps you can tell us a bit about how you ended up flying Tornadoes in the RAF.
For sure. Right. So I am the archetypal kid that has always loved aeroplanes. So grew up in the 70s, model aeroplanes, building them, then starting to fly them, cadets. I went to university mainly because my dad said it's a good idea to have a degree behind you. I would have had a go at joining the Air Force right from the get-go. But I fell in with some great people at university and joined the University Air Squadron. I'd done a flying scholarship with the Air Force in the age of 16, 17. So I'd started and dipped my toe in the water flying-wise at that point with them. But yeah, fell in with some great people on the Air Squadron. That gave me contact with the front line on University Air Squadron exchanges. So it's a bit like the ROTC in the US, similar sort of idea. And then I did apply for several sponsorships. Unfortunately, was unsuccessful for those. They would have been to, you know, give me a grant through various years of university, but eventually joined in 1991 in the September as a direct entry pilot. So obviously, that's just after the first Gulf War. So having got through officer training, there was a significant delay in the training pipeline. The legacy types like the F-4 Phantom and Buccaneer were being retired, and also some of the squadrons brought back from Germany. So that just led to a massive logjam in the flying training pipeline. So having finished officer training, I was working as an ops officer on a Tornado squadron at Honington for about a year. But that was a great experience. The guys were lovely. I learned a lot about the operational support for Tornado. I participated in TACAVAL, went on detachment with them and such like, before then continuing flying training. So having done basic flying training on the Tucano at Cranwell, again, there was another two-year hold waiting for me. I had some great jobs, though. I got to work for the Tucano display pilot at Cranwell. I was effectively his roadie, taking care of the admin, but the perks for that job were an opportunity to go around all the air shows. I got a chance to maybe fly the aircraft with another instructor on the wing to the destinations or lead back. Got to meet all the other display pilots, the Red Arrows, around the various air shows. So that was a great deal. And then we got moved around every 6 months, roughly. So having done some pain to repay that good deal, I am. Ended up going to 100 Squadron, which recently been closed as the Aggressor and Target Facility Squadron for the RAF. But at the time, again, it meant a return to the ops officer job, but just great exposure to support the front line, flying the Hawk. The pilots there were very, very generous with the stick time. I could fly the aircraft in the circuit and to and from the exercise area. Got a chance to work with the School of Fighter Control, and all of this is just building air picture SA and just becoming familiar with what the front line do. So I had 160 hours in the backseat of the Hawk by the time I turned up to TAC Weapons, which at the time was at RAF Valley.
Nick, the TAC Weapons course has a fairly well-established reputation as a difficult course to pass. I just wondered if you could talk us a little bit through the course, how it's different from the basic flying training that you've been through up until that point, and what sort of experiences you had going through it.
Yeah, like any good course, it's building blocks, crawl, walk, run. One of the things you notice flying the Hawk compared to the Tucano, which is what I'd come off, was flying faster, the wind affects you slightly less, so the lateral drift is less. That helps. You had a rule of thumb of you take the wind speed and then divide it by the number of miles per minute you're flying in true airspeed. So we would cruise around at 420 knots, 7 miles a minute. So you can see that even at a 20-knot crosswind or 21-knot crosswind would just give you 3 degrees of drift. So that made nav a little bit easier. I think local knowledge of Wales and selecting appropriate waypoints was a real key thing. I came back to TAC Weapons as an instructor after my first tour. So, you know, to generate spare mental capacity to supervise a student, local knowledge really, really helped. So when you first arrive as an instructor, developing that familiarity was a pretty steep learning curve, as well as going back to single pilot operations. But as a student, yeah, I think they're just taking care of the basics. Well, I think that the students that did well are those that could fly accurately, second nature. So that might mean trimming the aircraft appropriately. As a QFI, I had to get the word trim into the presentation early doors. So, but outside of that, it's kind of also just flying accurately. So fly an accurate 420 knots. And if you're not flying 420, make an adjustment, but come back to it and set something accurate. So all of those things make the aircraft predictable. You're less likely to be off the timeline or wandering. If you're wandering off the heading, that's not going to help, etc. So all the techniques that you're given, if you've got good discipline right from the start, that's going to help, I would say. But yeah, I mean, the phase you're talking about is the last phase, it's called the op phase. So to be clear, the time on target work you had done unopposed up until that point, all using map and stopwatch. And the way it was done was that you would start your plan with a time on target window. You would draw your IP to target run on a 50 thou map, so like an Ordnance Survey map. And then let's, for ease of description, maybe say that the target run was about a minute long. So you'd aim to hit the target 1 minute into your time on target window in this basic training scenario. And then basically plan your route back on the half mil map, that's your low flying chart, put back from that whole minute on the target and allow yourself some cut shorts. So put in some 90 degree turns to generate maybe what we would call a trombone that you can cut across, and then work it back towards the base. And when you had the nearest minute mark to the base, then you could start the stopwatch a few minutes before. They gave us a rule of thumb for how many minutes before takeoff you'd start the stopwatch. So it was really important to be watching your wristwatch. At that stage, you're generally crewing into the aeroplane, and then you would make a call over the squadron chat frequency, you know, at 10 seconds, and then your call sign, hack. And then from that point, the watch is running. And if you hacked it at the right point, then the minute marks on the stopwatch would coincide with the marks on the map. So you just you knew taxi times from experience. And let's say you'd had a chance to do this unopposed. And when you'd be looking to get airborne, of course, air traffic control get in the way or landing traffic get in the way. But once airborne, if you were smart during the planning cycle, you would use it was a Brady rule. So it's effectively a multi-function ruler that had different markings on it to cater for different speeds on the half mil map. And you go, well, if I went from here to here, it's gonna save me this many minutes. So I'd know a couple of big cut shorts, and I would also know what my max cut short was. So those things kind of helped you get on track on time. But as far as the evasion, the way it was done, really, you had one engagement before the target, which would put you off the timeline if you were on it from the start, and then they would allow you to get either to the target or where it was apparent that you were going to hit the target within the TOT, the time on target tolerances. So after that, you stuck to the black line, because it then meant that the bounce could find you. So after that, you would fly the black line, and you'd be engaged. having been a bounce pilot subsequently, the aim would be to give the student exposure to a variety of different engagements, an engagement from the stern, from the beam. And generally speaking, if we said like a beam engagement, what might happen is that you would turn the formation towards the bounce to achieve a 180 by a safe bubble distance. And then as the bandit turns, passing the rear man that he'd have to honor, generally speaking, we would turn in a two circle fashion. And that would put us to track six effectively. So heading back the way you came. And then you'd watch what the bandit was doing. And this is fairly canned evasion. It wasn't very wound up, but it was testing that you could fly the counters accurately. They were flown at 4G with full power. And if people reacted at the same time, when you rolled out track six, so heading back the way you come, you would be line abreast, just the sides were swapped. And so when you'd see the bandit disengaging, you would check each other's tail were clear, called cruise, and then a turnabout, which is a simultaneous turn back in the same direction that you evaded. So if you countered left, you'd do another left turn to head back track 12 the way you were going, and generally speaking that would put you about a minute late. So as you can see, it was canned, and it was there to put the student pilot off the timeline, but in a way that they could recover it. So when I was a bounce, then again, you're just thinking about, right, they've reacted before target. Yes, they were able to achieve the time on target. After that, give them exposure to different engagements. And if there was one that didn't go very well, then perhaps you might try to give them another opportunity for that. And after that, it's really about making sure they're aware of the fuel so that they know when to call terminate and then climb out. So yeah, that's pretty much how the evasion went at attack weapons.
So tell us about the weather then and the impact that it has on flying training. I've heard the expression, the green letterbox. What is that exactly?
So low flying rules in the UK are 5K vis, and you need to have 500 foot clear, ceiling clear of clouds. So if you had a ridge to cross that was 1,000 feet, then theoretically the cloud base would need to be a 1,500 foot AMSL to be legal. So a letterbox is where effectively the cloud is coming down close to the ridge top, but you can see through to the other side, and it might be called a temporary violation of the weather minima. But to get through the other side, sometimes it was better to do that than to risk pulling up into controlled airspace or pulling up into IMC, separating the formation or things like that. So generally speaking, the letterbox was that minor infraction of the weather limits to get through for the greater good, I'd like to say.
And how much do you think the weather really impacted you as a student pilot? Was it a big concern? I think everybody listening will know that weather is a killer, that people fly into the weather trying to avoid it or fly up into the weather and get disoriented. Was it a big factor for you?
We were dimly aware of, okay, you were going to hit the op phase in the summer. That might be easier. So I think at some stage, the course was generally long enough that you'd encounter weather at one stage of the course or other. And I guess when you compare those of us who went through the pure RAF training system with those who were out at Shepherd Air Force Base doing NGEPT, you know, we thought perhaps that they had been used to better weather, you know, I think Shepherd's Texas, is it? But yeah, blue skies and, you know, not having to deal with the European weather. And obviously a lot of the European pilots and navigators I got to fly with on TEE had trained out in the States. And again, coming back to European weather was certainly something that they were going to have to deal with. I think typically as an instructor, what you saw from students, if the weather was poor or they were uncertain of their position, was that they would start to slow down and pull up, which is, of course, the worst thing you can do. If you start to slow down on map and stopwatch navigation, you're no longer where you're expecting to be. If you've planned your route at 7 miles a minute, say 420 knots, so you did see people start to ease up. And then if you're flying a beam them in the other airplane, you can see, okay, I'm having to slow down to stay abreast of them. And you that's going to introduce errors. And pulling up obviously brings you closer to the weather. So that was one of the things we would try and emphasize to the students as a staff mate. But as a student, of course, yeah, there's nothing more reassuring than having turned at one waypoint you roll out on heading and you can already see the next one, because it was a really good feature that you'd chosen. And there are various euphemisms and slang names for various hills and masts around Wales where this training was carried out. So yeah, you were definitely aware of the weather. I think I'd like to think instructors, when I was going through as a student, would make some allowance for the fact it was a tougher weather day. Of course, there's a minimum standard to have met. I mean, I do remember I did fail a trip with a good buddy of mine who's a very talented guy, went on to fly the Harrier, but we were flying grey painted hawks as opposed to the black ones that you see these days, and it was just a bit hazy. I was trying to fly a tactical battle formation, which is like combat spread, kind of 2,000 yards line abreast, and yeah, I just got too far, and the viz wasn't great, and you know, I lost sight of my leader. I think my buddy was leading at the time. So yeah, weather's a thing. I think the worst, I guess in summary, the worst case is where the weather's marginal. If the weather's blatantly unfit, that's okay, I'll get to reconvene and go another day. And if the weather's beautiful, then yeah, let's go. But it's when it's low cloud base, or it's, you know, you've got to have a go, and the instructors will be looking for that, as long as you don't ping the weather limits. Yeah, but obviously it burnt extra brain cells.
What were the instructional techniques like then when you went through the TAC weapons course as a student? I think some people will be familiar with the old 1981 BBC series, which was called, I think, Fighter Pilot. And there was some very interesting instructional technique on display there. Were the instructors easygoing? How were they to work with?
I think there was a big change. I mean, I went through the course in 96 and I came back as an instructor at the end of 2000, maybe 2000. By the time I was fully qualified onto, you know, teaching the syllabus, 2001. And it was interesting, you know, maybe this is a generational thing, but when I was a student, the instructors were gods. You called them sir, they knew everything, they never made mistakes. And so, yeah, I guess maybe I wasn't 100% confident. I knew it was a super tough course and I just wanted to do everything I could to pass. You know, that meant prepping the briefing slides, making sure I knew all the questions they were going to ask or could ask. So, you know, I think they respected people who were working hard, who really wanted to pass, and they would help you. Yes, there was the occasional, you know, raised voice, but, you know, I just kind of saw the wings on their chest, and we didn't have them at that stage. The wings were awarded on graduation from TAC Weapons. So that was the prize. And I wanted to join the cool kids who had the wings on their chests. So I was going to do whatever it took to pass. So fast forward to coming back as an instructor, you know, as you'd identified, I come from an aeroplane flying the Tornado GR1 on my first tour with a navigator in the back, INS, lots of aids. GPS was just starting to make its presence felt. To go back to going map and stopwatch in Wales and sometimes some dodgy weather, with the pressure to deliver, you know, a good demo, a perfect demo, ideally, of an attack run or whatever it was. And I'm going, hang on a sec, those guys always got it right. I'm not perfect. I was just all too painfully aware that, you know, I could make mistakes. So I guess, and I, in terms of my approach as an instructor, was really to be open and honest and say, right, if I made a mistake, call it before anybody else does. I think the worst fear credibility wise is, you know, you're trying to critique a student and offer hints and tips, but they're thinking, hang on a sec, that recovery was a shambles, you know. So if things don't go very well, is to highlight it and say, right, where do you think that went wrong? What could I have done better to really call the elephant in the room and make every mistake a learning point, you know, and so show that nobody's past making mistakes. I think that my perception was the students were less deferential, and I don't know how that could be in just like 4 years, but you know, that was my perception. But as I said, as an instructor, where somebody showed they were committed, they were putting in the work, that you would bend over backwards to help them. And you know, although TAC Weapons had a reputation for chopping people, it was very carefully audited. So if somebody failed a trip, it was a straight refly fine. There was what they call remedial action report, so RAR, RAR 1, straight refly. Okay, too many safety points, right? But you can address those, right? Technique is sound, address those points, pass the next trip, go on, no further action. RAR 2 is where there was a more systemic problem. So typically what might happen, you would assess the training needs of the student pilot, come up with a syllabus of maybe one or two trips, the content of which was tailored to that individual, and then they get the refly. And then RAR 3 is the chop ride. But by that stage, the escalation could be gradual. So I think, you know, it certainly felt in the 96 when I went through, yeah, the cliff edge was never very far away. I think a lot of that self-imposed pressure. Having been an instructor, you know, you do your best to get the students through. I can remember, you know, I did fail one or two trips going through tail weapons, and I remember walking in from the line or to the line hut to sign the jet in and seeing the instructor looking rather grim. And I was thinking, oh shit, I pissed him off. I know I've probably flunked the trip. Oh, he's really cross with me. But then, you know, fast forwards, you know, 4 years or whatever it was, I was probably that instructor with a fairly stern look on my face. But do you know what I'm thinking? Is like, to what extent did I contribute to that? Did I not brief it right? Did I interrupt his train of thought or something like that? So who knows if the guys who were my instructors thought that. I think they did. I mean, ultimately, they can tell when somebody's a good egg and wants to help them through. So I think that more than likely was the case.
When you came back as an instructor to attack weapons then, did you find that your time on the Tornado meant that you had already sort of mastered the stick and rudder skills of actually just flying a fast jet? Did you have to think much about the business of flying the Hawk when you got back to Chivna? Or was it something that you could just do without really thinking about it, and that left you with the mental capacity then to take up the instructional side of things?
So I think flying the Tornado could make you a little bit lazy in the instrument flying side of things. There was a phrase used by one of my German instructors when I went through Treble TE, and the phrase he used was a HUD cripple. With the legacy instruments, it's really important to have a disciplined selective radial scan. So what does that mean? Well, the center of the instrument cluster generally is the artificial horizon. So that's your primary instrument. So most of your time should be spent looking at that with glances to the left, right, up or down for other instruments. And as you approach, for example, a level off, the selective bit means you start to scan the altimeter more frequently as you approach the level off. Or if you're accelerating to a speed, you scan the speed indicator a bit more often. But it's always going via the artificial horizon or attitude indicator, whatever it's called in your aircraft. So coming back, it really re-emphasized the importance of the fundamentals. So I think the Tornado with things in the HUD, it was easy to become lazy. Things were, it was a digital HUD in terms of the speed and things like that, and heading. And so instead of, you know, when flying a visual circuit, for example, you could put symbology on the beam the pappies or bring them down to the numbers and the approach path is sorted, whereas it's much more just look out the window, what's the runway aspect doing, and then glancing in to scan your parameters. So I certainly found, I think, by the time I came back to the front line from my instructional tour, I'd really embedded the fundamentals in my own flying. And I think that was really important to do. I think overall, flying the Hawk, they gave you a lot of handrails as well. So returning to the Tornado as an instructor, as a squadron QFI, I was really passionate about giving people handrails that weren't there. So up until that point, right, if you're trying to do a max rate turn in the training fit, you need roughly this pitch angle, you need roughly this or that. All of that was supplied in the student handbook for the Hawk. So I think there was a case of relearning some of the stuff, like the importance of flying an accurate heading, or I mean the Hawk did fly by numbers, so you know, if you set an instrument pattern 87%, then you know it's going to sit at 300 knots. That's brilliant, you know. So it's again just good fundamentals.
So as an instructor who had the fate of students in his hands then, and that was of course only 4 or so years after you yourself had been in their very position, how did it feel? I mean, in a sense, I suppose you're God in a way.
I like to think I never forgot how stressful it was going through the course as a student. to give you an idea of my experience, you know, it was a weekend, went to see my girlfriend, I'd always end up coming back in time for dinner at 5 in the mess, and I'd spend the evening studying for the trip the next day. So that effectively meant the weekend with a girlfriend finished at about lunchtime. So you curtail your personal life to commit to the process. If I was flying over the lunch hour, I would have a light lunch because I didn't want to feel dozy. You know, you become very aware of what you needed to do to operate at peak performance. So coming back as an instructor, I just aware of that. And I like to think I didn't lose compassion for the students from that point of view. I think one thing the RAF is good at is they do move you around after a period of time. So as you get towards the end of the tour, you might be flying a certain sortie, and you can brief the student, right? Common errors are this, this, and this. And you know it's time to move on if you start to get frustrated. You go, I told you were going to make those mistakes, and me briefing you didn't stop you making them. And I think it's time to move on when you lose that kind of patience and compassion for the student. So after my 3 years, you know, I got involved in instructor workups, which is great fun, as well as bringing the pressure to deliver a good demo. But in terms of playing God, yeah, it's somebody's dreams you hold in your hands. And I think, you know, I never did anyone's chop ride per se. That was at a higher level in terms of the squadron hierarchy. But yeah, I don't think I ever lost sight of that. And I think it's right and proper that the instructors to this day remember that and, treat, you know, what they say and do and how they interact with the students appropriately with that in mind.
As you went through TAC Weapons then, was the experience starting to guide or influence what it was that you wanted to do once you got through in terms of whether it would be air defence, single seat, ground attack, recce, whatever?
So the structure of the TAC Weapons course is really, having flown the Hawk and got the navigation instrument flying, all the basics of military flying stowed away, then it was about exposing you to the different disciplines, introducing the idea of using the aircraft as a weapon system. And I guess you kind of seeing what you're good at, both for you to see what you're good at, what you enjoy, and the two are usually linked. I guess my background growing up reading autobiographies of fighter pilots in World War II was that I'd really wanted to fly fighters in the RAF sense of the word, which I would say air defense. So the only air defense aircraft around was the Tornado F3 at the time I came through. So when I was holding on the Tornado squadron after officer training, I made the mistake of saying that that's the way I might want to go. So I was met with a storm of derision. I was holding on 13 squadron, which was one of the recce squadrons. And so they ripped the piss out of me mercilessly for saying that. As it happened coming through the course, I think I did a bit better with a plan to hand. The situation in terms of available slots for the conversion units was such that I would have had to wait it for the Tornado F3. At the time the Italians were being trained onto the aircraft, it was being used as I understand it, as a fill-in for the F-104 or to augment the F-104 in terms of its capability. So the Italian pilots and then the Wizzos had priority going through Coningsby at the time. So it would have been a wait. When it came to my role disposal, they said, well, you could go either way, but that's the ramification of choosing air defense. What do you think? And I really wasn't right on the par for single seat fair dues. You know, I was a solid two seat guy. So, with that in mind, I put the Tornado GR1 as my first choice. The other choices being available were the single seat for the Harrier and for the Jaguar. So those were the main platform still flying at the time. So you get a pretty good idea of what you're best suited for. And that meant potentially going back to squadrons or working with people that I'd worked with on 13 squadron as a holding guy. So, I think you kind of know. I mean, these days, of course, it's very different because everyone's single seat. And you know, you're a multi-role stroke swing role operator. So you've got to be good at pretty much everything, not least workload management.
What was the distinction then between what you said was a single seat guy and what you thought you were at that time then?
It's interesting, actually. That I say interesting because coming back as an instructor was a great opportunity to fly with people from different backgrounds. I ended up back on my instructor's course with one of my course mates from my ab initio course, and he went to the Harrier, and very talented guy, went on to display the Harrier. And and we had exchange guys who'd flown the Mirage, Australian F-18s. So I suppose in my mind, I'd gone built these people up. Right, they are superhuman. Their SA is always completely crystal clear. And then I went flying with them. And it's not to sort of denigrate them in any way, but I'm going, I could do that a little bit better, actually. And I'm not trying to say, there's always an element of competition. You measure yourself. You measure yourself against your colleagues, and especially those that you respect and you look up to. I think the difference is workload management and being able to keep spare mental capacity. So even in the airline world that I'm in now, we talk about the capacity bucket. So everyone has a bucket of a given size. Now, your bucket might be bigger than mine. But sometimes stuff happens in aviation, which leads to a massive increase in workload. And the skill is being able to always keep some room in the bucket for that last pint's worth that goes in. And I just think those guys are just able to think clearly under pressure, process information, and recognize what to prioritize when. Interestingly, I got to the end of a course that I was running. And there was one guy, he was very talented. He was a Cambridge graduate, and he aced the course, and he got posted to the Harrier and subsequently went on to run the Harrier weapons instructor course, obviously having passed the course himself. So like that is pretty much the top of the pile at the time. So I do his end of course interview, and I'm interested in the psychology, and I just thought, I wonder what he'll say to this. I know this is going to be a strange question, but how do you do what you do? You know, if I was trying to get you to explain to somebody who was struggling, how do you do it? How is it your SA, your capacity is so much better? And he just described, he had to think for a moment. I think he was surprised to be asked that by an instructor because I think, well, the instructors know. Well, when somebody's very good, I think learning by imitation is a really powerful tool. So he paused and he said, well, I think what I'm able to do is run several, maybe three or four event lines. So using the evasion thing that we were talking about, when I last looked out, I'd seen the bandit. He wasn't threatening. He was left 9 o'clock high, going track six. Okay, when I last looked at the fuel gauge, it said 700 kilos, and the next critical fuel, the Joker fuel, is 600 at a certain waypoint. And he can go back and go, well, I last looked at the bandit 10 seconds ago. So he was there. He's now going to be there. And he's able to maintain these concurrent timelines and they're all happening at the same time. So somebody who is struggling, perhaps maybe not, as we were saying, flying an accurate heading or speed wing, he's over controlling the throttle. So he's doing 430 knots, then 410, never settled right on the way he needs to be. So he's making adjustments. That takes capacity. Or if you are working hard and become flustered, then your thought processes become more muddled. So I just think, over the years, the SA and all of these things are about prior preparation, but just getting into the zone, thinking calmly, clearly, and smoothly.
How much does the environment then, the sheer physical environment of being in a fast jet cockpit, of moving through the air, being in turbulence, experiencing Gs, how much does that impact a student pilot? Are there people that if you put them in the sim, which is effectively 1G and 0 knots, they can do everything, they can do the mental arithmetic. But once they actually get into that environment, they start to struggle.
I think a lot of it's down to prior preparation. If you've planned your route and you surveyed the airspace over the top, and you can keep in mind when you did your route study that airspace might be a factor at the time and only at this time, and what critical numbers are, you can rather than worrying about every single piece of airspace, maybe just think about the worst case, the lowest bit of controlled airspace over the top. In terms of physical environment, obviously being bounced around in the cockpit can degrade, and still turbulence still degrades people's SA in airliners these days. The Hawk being a low wing loading aircraft, you know, we were flying in the Snowdonia, it could get bounced around quite severely. The Tornado was a much smoother ride, so it becomes harder to see the instruments. Even you find out if your straps weren't tight enough pretty quickly if you're going down a valley and the rotors are bouncing you around. So that can affect your ability to think clearly. I maybe think also about defensive combat. If you're becoming defensive and you're in a rate spiral towards base, you're holding max G and you're becoming fatigued, just trying to keep on top of everything can be hard as you become fatigued. It's not unknown for people to hurt their necks, looking back over their shoulder under G. And the environment could be the sun. If the bandit goes into sun, it could be hard. So yeah, all of these things can play their part. I think they're starting to come this way with a lot of the training. I've heard it in the States as well. A lot of it, maybe we did intuitively, but we'll call it chair flying. These days, you know, in other disciplines like athletics or it's visualization. I think if you can put yourself in that situation and prepare yourself mentally, where I'm going to need to look for this bit of information, that bit of information, the time spent chair flying or visualizing is always time well spent. And I think you can offset to a degree some of the environmental challenges because you've anticipated them. You go, oh yeah, I'm expecting that. And perhaps there isn't the surprise factor.
So when you realized then that you were likely to go to ground attack and tornado, did it change how you approached the TAC weapons course and the amount of time that you spent individually or personally rather focusing on the air defense mission?
So the point of the course, I did the air defense stuff. So air defense in terms of the TAC weapons course was beyond visual range practice intercepts. Once you've got the hang of the intercept geometry side of things as singletons, as in like what, you know, you've got a single target and you're just navigating your own way to the intercept, they then would introduce the wingman. So you're doing pairs intercepts. Now that sort of stuff had happened earlier on in the course. For me, that it's kind of modularized in that way. Sometimes the seasonality had a say in it. So if the days were very short, then they might have moved the weapons phase in, and by that I mean going to Pembrey Range to drop practice bombs and fire the gun. That might have been moved to a different stage. So there was some interchangeability that could happen. But as it got to the end of the course, for me, the air defense and the 2v1 air combat side of things was done and dusted by then. So honestly, I think the short answer to your question is that you just do your absolute best every day. And I just wanted to leave everything out on the playing field. If it didn't work out, I wanted to know that I tried my best. So the destination really, you know, it just passing the course was the thing. Destination really was not, for me at least, a prime concern. I think if you, because I was not under any illusion, I wasn't really Harrier Jaguar kind of material. I think if you were, then perhaps you might be sort of fretting, oh, I only got a six is a perfect score. So if they're going, oh, I only got a four in that one, or maybe even a three, they might be going, oh God, is that my single seat recommend under jeopardy? But no, for me at least, it was just like, pass the course, do your absolute best every time. And if it doesn't work out, at least you know you've done that.
And how many fast jet hours did you have by the time you finished the course?
I hadn't surveyed that. I mean, I think it's more than these days, but I think probably did, if you call fast jet, there's just the Hawk. I think it was something like 80 hours, something like that. I'm really plucking that out of thin air as a real rough guess. I had, as I said, a lot of time flying the Hawk as a sandbag, as a backseater and just extra crew member beforehand. And with the other holding, I'd done lots of extra hours in the Tucano. So it's all airmanship. It's all time dealing with weather, making decisions, trying to embed the fundamentals. So I was quite lucky. I had quite a few hours extra under my belt. It's actually an interesting point to raise it because it reminds me that with those 2 year holds, some people chose to go back to university and do a degree or something like that, or a short course and a master's or something like that. But I just thought, you know, this is, I'm finally doing what I wanted to do. And so I just want to commit 100% to passing the course. So the jobs that I looked to do were all in support of that. But it did mean that I had just that little bit more flying under my belt. And I think it made a difference, certainly the time on 100 Squadron, you know, just seeing stuff. And that's really what I wanted. I, you know, perhaps wasn't that confident. I just went, well, I want to give myself the best chance of passing, and I'll do whatever it took, or do whatever it takes to kind of to achieve those things.
I suppose then that you can sympathize a little with the RAF's current crop of trainee pilots. I think some of whom are taking as many as 7 years to get to a frontline squadron. You know, you obviously had the dedication and the focus and the ambition, but did you have to have a word with yourself, or did you have to tell yourself certain things in order to stay focused during those two breaks in flying training?
Totally sympathize for the guys and girls going through training right now, with the prospect of those holds. I think if you want it enough, you'll do whatever's required. As for me, the goal was really just pass the next course and pass the next course and pass the next course. One of the benefits of holding were that, and it's not much of a benefit, but you at least knew you were still in the game. You hadn't been chopped. So people could, you know, do adventurous training, get all your leave. You know, I had a lot of fun on the holding jobs that I did. You know, there were times 100 Squadron at one stage was based at RAF Finningley, which is where all the navigation training was going. So lots of my oppos going through the course. They were obviously under pressure, but you know, Thursday night in Donny was a good night out, and so we didn't have any of that kind of pressure. But as for the people now, the holds can move like any big organization. The Air Force seems to be in a perpetual PIO, pilot induced oscillation, out of phase with the requirements of the front line. They can't train enough, and then there are holds, and it's just it's always been like that. So I think a lot about aviation, and this is not just military aviation, is the right being in the right place at the right time, and you know, that's just luck. You can't skew that, really. So I would just encourage them to try and make the best use of their time doing whatever courses that will help them later on. There's I remember doing, for example, it was called the JORSC, which was the basic weapons employment, but it would give you exposure to some stuff from industry, other platforms, coalition types, NATO types. So you can bag all this stuff. Perhaps you don't have the full context for it, and of course by the time you get to the front line, the technology's changed, but you know, it's really motivating to see sort of weapons that you can go on to employ, the technology that's coming your way. That's exciting and can keep you, you know, keeping the faith, I suppose.
And when you held on 13 Squadron then, did you get to learn much about the aeroplane?
13 Squadron was at Honington, which was still a flying base, but we're talking 92, 93, and it did close not long after I left. I did get a trip. It's very rare for passenger flights to be given on the Tornado. Typically, VIPs, or maybe there's a list on the station that would people would put themselves on, and they gradually work their way to the top. We would also, on all the squadrons that I've flown on, flown the engineers, which is, I think, really important to kind of give them that perspective of what happens when the chocks are waved off and what the aircraft goes to do. But I was very lucky. I got a trip with an ex-JAG guy called K2, and we actually did some air refueling as well. It was a strike, so there wasn't a stick in the back seat for me to fly the aeroplane. But I got a chance to see air refueling. He asked me to read the checklist, and as I'm sure we'll come on to, the nav system in the Tornado required some management in the GR1. That is, there was kit drift, etc. So he involved me in fixing the navigation kit when we came off the tanker and went to low level north of Newcastle. So I it was great. I got a chance to kind of participate in the flight. We went to the weapons range. But I was extremely lucky. I was on the squadron for about a year, and I certainly did my best as the ops officer. And I think that was, generally speaking, recognized and rewarded with the PAX trip and the Tornado. So, yeah, it was wonderful.
And so did that give you the opportunity to really learn what the aeroplane could do, though? I'm trying to work out whether or not by the time you arrived at the training pipeline for the Tornado proper, you already knew a bit about the jet and you'd already had some exposure to what it could do and what it couldn't do.
I think the things that it really helped was less the technical bits of the aeroplane, more the op support stuff that went around it. So, you know, a typical sortie would involve a first run attack in the range. So I knew booking that or booking slots in Spedad and the electronic warfare training range. As for the aircraft itself, I don't recall when I got to the Tornado going, oh yeah, I can remember particular bits about it. The mission planning system hadn't changed from when I was an ops officer to when I got to Cottesmore on Treble TE, and these days you'd laugh at it. They called it subsequently the Green Goddess, but it had like massive floppy disks, and were kind of this wide. It was a magnetic table, and you loaded the mission data, having kind of moused the route in on this, having got the map accepted on the table. It recognised it's a half mil map. You've planned in pen and ink and the geometry of your route, and then you mouse in the waypoints and then load that onto the audio cassettes, the old TDK audio cassettes. And that hadn't changed from 92 or so when I was an ops officer to when I started at Treble TE. And indeed, it was the original planning system from when the aircraft first came to service in 82. So it was pretty archaic by that stage. It was pretty much hit the ground and start ground school. And ground school was extensive at Treble TE. Like, I seem to remember around 8 weeks or something like that. Tri-National Tornado Training Establishment. It was based at RAF Cottesmore, and it had the Germans, the Italians, and the Brits. So we all came together flying a pool of aircraft taken from different nations, so GR1s and also the IDS variants from the Luftwaffe and the Italian Air Force as well.
Tell us then about the academics at Treble TE.
Yeah, I think the thing is just a level up in terms of complexity. So if you went from, say, the Tucano has manually actuated flight controls, you know, and it may be cables, pulleys, things like that. Then you go to the Hawk, it's got powered flight controls. And then you go to the Tornado. It did have fly-by-wire, duplex, I think. And so, you know, that and the hydraulics. And then you've got all sorts of other systems. You know, generically all aircraft have electrical systems. But you're adding radar, you're adding, with the engines, you're adding reheat. So there was just a lot of extra stuff to cover, a lot of it for the first time. So reheat, I mean, I've enjoyed it at air shows. So with all due respect to Harrier mates and A10 drivers, it's cool. I'm sorry if you haven't got it, then you're on the back foot straight away. But you're having to learn about how that works. This is all in the days before PowerPoint, really. It was very much OHP slides and with a lecture, you know, a live instructor talking to you about it, and you obviously had the student study guide to read and cockpit procedures trainers that you could sit in and learn the flow of the checks, which, like, you know, USAF and military aircraft around the world, really, it's done by scan flow. So you learn the checks in order, and it's more about going, okay, I remember I'm going around the cockpit in this flow. As I come past that switch, I'm looking to do that with it or check this indication at that point. So that it was a fairly basic procedures training for what I can remember, but I think it did allow you to do things like an engine start, so you could actually switch stuff on. And what you'd have back in your room was just the old school cardboard cockpit, which would just have a flat depiction of what the cockpit looked like. But it was still really important because it took a lot of switchery to get the Tornado started. It was important to embed those habit patterns because it just meant you start the jet quicker, you can go flying quicker, and obviously, you know, looking to create a good impression. In depth. And then the ground school was supported by the simulator. But of course, in those days, there were no visuals. It was a frosted canopy. You got airborne, but it was all IMC from the get-go, which is the same as the, from what I can recall, the Hawk simulator was certainly like that when I went through the T1 and the Tucano. Can't remember if they had visuals, but yeah, you were used to it just being IMC. That was kind of the, there was a lot of learning. But I'd say in comparison to the civil aviation world, you did feel well equipped when you came out. And by that I mean, you know, fairly quickly you'd be flying in a jet with an instructor navigator in the back, and he didn't have all the warning panel captions that you'd have in the front. You needed to be good enough to kind of deal with all the emergencies, and you'd be put through your paces in the simulator. And I think I just noticed coming into the airline world, obviously I'm flying with an experienced captain, and it just doesn't seem to be to the same depth. It achieves regulatory compliance, of course, and it's all safe before people start panicking. But you know, the depth that you went through in a military ground school, you know, you really did feel much more on top of it. And you needed to be.
We had Tug Wilson on the channel talking about the F4 training pipeline, and he talked about the pressure and the fact that he was living from one day to the next, and he had this concept of learning about something, taking an exam or flying a sortie in order to pass it, and then effectively dumping that knowledge from memory once the ride had been passed or the test had been completed. I suppose it's similar in a way to the capacity bucket that you were talking about, a sort of parallel concept. Did you have a similar experience to Tuck?
I think, you know, when you've been in it for a while, going through the various courses, it becomes a norm. It was interesting. I went back through my logbook to gather just a few stats in case you asked. And it was funny, the feelings that reading through the various sorties brought back. You know, you get, you know, snapshot memories. Sometimes it's an event, or sometimes it was a feeling. Oh, yeah, I remember that was high pressure. And it's funny when you go back to it, because I like to think my life is not as high pressured. It is something that, you know, the pressure is there. Learn and dump. I think you obviously had knowledge to your fingertips for that particular sortie, and obviously in terms of surviving the brief is making sure that you had the answers to your fingertips for the stuff that was safety critical or technical, just anything for that particular sortie. I'm not aware so much of learn and dump with that. I think the reality is that they put us back through the sim to do emergencies procedures and stuff like that, because they recognize that you're focused on other stuff and you need to consolidate on the basics. You know, what was that particular boldface or memory item? You know, why are you doing that action in the sim? You know, what are the key limits and things like that? So the syllabuses were always, and the sortie content through the flying phase, always had that in mind. I think you came back to kind of consolidating on the stuff that you really need to. So I think there was a difference in attitude between Treble TE and the Tornado Weapons Conversion Unit. We felt it was unlikely that we were going to fail Treble TE. You know, it wasn't that you were going to take it easy, but it felt like a lower pressure environment. With that said, one of my buddies did get chopped, and I think it just shows you can never take your eye off the ball. You just never know how close to the cliff edge you are. It comes back to what my attitude was, to always do your best. But certainly when coming to TWICU, as the Tornado Weapons Conversion Unit acronym was, you know, we were very much expecting to be, you know, given a bike shedding, right, you're back into the RAF hard school, you know, you've had it soft now, so you better up your game, you know. And so that was kind of, I suppose that's the rumour mongering and the scaremongering that goes on in preparation for going up there. But it certainly felt like, right, this is about to ratchet up again. And life, learning goes on when you pass the last OCU, because then you've got combat ready check. But the goal of getting to your first frontline squadron, you know, passing the TWICU syllabus, the weapons conversion unit with the RAF again, that was very much in my mind, it's like, okay, this is getting serious again.
And what did your mate get chopped for?
It was fairly early on in the Treble T syllabus. I'd always thought he was a pretty steady, competent aviator, and I'm not meaning to suggest that he wasn't, but I think it just shows that the downward spiral can be very tight and very steep if you take your eye off the ball, and that perhaps he always appeared relaxed, and perhaps I couldn't say for sure whether he was genuinely struggling and wanting to portray a relaxed demeanor, or he wasn't on his A game and struggled with, from what I can remember, air picture, positional awareness. So perhaps if you're doing general handling and you're too close to an airway and things like that, you've got the moving map display between your knees. Are you staying orientated and going, okay, we just finished that package of maneuvering, I'll just progress further west to get away from the airway. But yeah, 1 minute, he was on the course ahead. Next minute, he's struggling, and then fairly quickly, he was gone. I mean, he's gone on to have a very successful career in air refueling, and all credit to him. Done a lot of good work, and he's done a lot of time over operational theatres doing that. So, I'm sure he found his way to the right place in the end.
You mentioned instructors from three countries. Were they teaching only their fellow countrymen, or were they spread across the board?
No, we so there were three squadrons. So let's get this right. A was the German squadron, I think. B for Brit, as you can imagine, and C was the Italian squadron. So that just meant who was in command of it. But each squadron had a mix of instructors from a variety of the partner nations. So my first instructor on the Italian squadron was a German. He was an Oberstleutnant. So he'd flown the F4 in recce role, and then went on to fly the Tornado. I think he was coming to the end of his career in the Air Force. So, he used that phrase, HUD cripple, because he'd flown the Phantom and then gone on to flying the Tornado, and recognized how you could lose the skill of using the legacy instruments, which the Tornado still had. And if the head-up display failed, you would be onto the standby dials, and there were certain key maneuvers which you had to fly on the head-down attitude indicator. So, yeah, we flew with a variety, and I think my first trip with a navigator was an Italian navigator. So, yeah, a mixture of instructors, which was great.
And were there differences in the instructional techniques between the three nations?
Not really. I think they all enjoyed the flying. So, there might be some national stereotypes you're alluding to here between the Germans and the Italians. But no, they were all really good. They enjoyed the job. It was, I think, a fairly relaxed job for them, and, out of their host nation Air Force, really. So they were all relaxed and very supportive in terms of the characteristics of the squadron. So C squadron was the Italian squadron, as I said. We did notice some differences in the crew room, for example. I know this sounds like maybe a small thing, but so we all know the Italians love a good coffee, and I know you love a good coffee, and I love a good coffee. But a typical RAF crew room had high energy rations like Mars bars, all sort of unhealthy stuff that you might need if you're just grabbing a quick snack before going flying. And you could maybe make yourself a sandwich with that. So that you'd experience that, and you're used to that on every squadron that you've been on, or every training unit that you've been on. But the Italian squadron had none of that. I mean, where's the Mars bars? But they did have a superior coffee maker. And I went through the Cottesmore course between January and April, and obviously the Trent Valley is prone to fog and poor weather at that stage. So one of the RAF flying traditions, I think anyone who's been through maybe flying training anywhere, in fact, is when you've got like a weather clamp and you're sat on the ground and it's fog, and the Met man always says, oh, it's going to clear at 10Z, and then it rolls and the forecast gets delayed. And but what the Italians and C squadron did, was they'd open a bottle of wine, and we're going, well, we're definitely not going flying now. And the Italian staff gave us a pasta demo, and so what that meant was that just go to the base naffy and got some herbs and spices, flavored some oil, boil some pasta, and you could do all this in a very basic kitchenette setup in the coffee bar. and we had pasta and we drank wine. I'm going, this is great, because there's no chance of a 4 o'clock clearance and right, launch the fleet, which was usually provoking a stream of adrenaline in all student pilots, you know, when you're just thinking, oh, I can relax for the day, I'm not going flying. And then all of a sudden you get that clearance at the end of the day. So so there was that kind of cultural difference. But that said, I don't mean to kind of say that they were unprofessional anyway. You know, they were great guys, and I've got fond memories of a flying on Sea Squadron. But it was just a very stark contrast that they would commit to the forecast rather than hanging out there for a last minute clearance.
Nick, what was the difference between Triple T and TwicU?
Right, so I think of Treble TE as like an initial aircraft conversion. So just glancing at my list, I think the syllabus basically included the ground school, that was the basic aircraft tech, as we've talked about. Once you start flying it from the pilot side of things, the first six trips were pilot conversion. That's, you know, the obvious circuits, takeoffs and landings. But because you're not teaching someone from scratch, it would also involve low flying and instrument flying. You know, the things that really strike you when you come from the Hawk to the Tornado is thrust reverse, wing sweep, reheat, you know, managing, you know, not just map and stopwatch navigation, but managing a navigation system with fixes. And so all of that sort of stuff could be incorporated on a pilot conversion sortie. It came fairly quick, you know, and you're thinking, okay, six trips. I mean, crikey, I feel more happy in a Hawk right now. And you're saying I'm about to get my solo clearance. And of course you were ready. It just happens at a much faster rate when you're already a winged pilot. So that was the initial kind of stage. You get an instrument rating fairly quickly after that. And after that, you're really moving on to navigation sorties, which would incorporate the terrain following radar. It's obviously the thing the Tornado is known for. It's not unique to the Tornado. It's clearly in the Strike Eagle, and it was in the F-111 before it. But the syllabus was really tailored to getting you comfortable with the system, building your faith in it by day. We also would do some weapons delivery profiles. Now that sounds kind of a bit out of place with the basic conversion, but what the Tornado Force called the loft recovery, I think it's more accurately called a toss recovery, is an instrument maneuver. To talk through it briefly, involves the aircraft flying at around 520 knots towards the target from low level, following a flight director command pull up about 2 to 3 G, and then commanding a release of a simulated weapon somewhere at around, depending on the standoff you had programmed, 30 degrees nose up, something like that. So the nature of flying on head-up displays is that when the symbology is moving rapidly, it becomes hard to go, was that the 10-degree bar I was just passing, or was that the 5-degree bar, and is it up or down? It can be quite disorientating. So once simulated weapons release had happened, the procedure was to go on to the head-down instruments. The beauty of that is you can see straight away that, you know, from the color of the half of the globe that you're looking at, oh, that's sky, that's ground. But you would transfer to that, and you would then just keep the G on and roll to 135 degrees of bank, and then just maintain the pull as hands in the bar, but the aircraft starting to pull back towards the horizon. And then about 10 degrees nose up, you'd start to unwind the roll so that you hit 90 degrees at the horizon, 5 degrees pitch at 60 degrees of bank as you're going down. And at that point, with everything nice and stable, the radar would start reading and you'd start to transition back to the head-up display. So that is something that was tested in every instrument flying test that any Tornado pilot did. So although it's a tactical application, it's an academic handling maneuver. Clearly, well, I hope it's clear that, you know, if you're doing this at night or IMC, that the potential for control flight into terrain is massive, because you're very high speed, you're pulling G, you're climbing, and then all of a sudden you're overbanking below safety altitude to pull back towards the horizon. In a tactical environment, you would have calculated a 5-mile width corridor and worked out what altitude would give you 500-foot clearance above the terrain in that corridor. So you're below safety altitude, but you're above what's called a minimum en route altitude. But this is a handling exercise that was dealt with in the initial pilot conversion.
And I'm trying to remember, but I think there might have been a couple of tornadoes that were lost flying that maneuver. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. The kind of areas of hazard, I would say, as far as this, the kind of toss or loft recovery, were twofold. Well, one in particular for the strike weapons that they would use the reheat. And in fact, I remember doing reheat loft. Gives you a further standoff. You're imparting more energy to the weapon, so you can stand off further. So for a strike and weapon employment, you can see that would be a good thing. But it was absolutely vital that when the weapon came off and the sight reverted to from a weapons display to an en route navigation display, that you cancelled the reheat before or as you overbanked, because the penalty for failing to do that would be you overbank and pull back down and the aircraft would accelerate just an unbelievable rate, and there's the risk of piling into the ground. So I think that there may have been accidents associated with that, but not least also in the weapons pattern at night. A lot of the British weapons ranges are coastal in bays, so you're flying over the water at night. There isn't too many visual references, and it was just really important that you control the rate of descent, making a high call every 100 feet. So I think we lost some aeroplanes in the early days descending to run in 150 feet in that base turn. So generally speaking, what we would do is let down from 1,000 foot downwind to about 500 in the base turn, and then complete the let down to 150 feet whilst running into the target. So you're not trying to capture the LOA or line of attack for the target, as well as manage your descent. You could get down to 500 feet halfway around. There was a gate about 10 degrees off the desired line of attack. And then you can roll out on the attack and then continue your acceleration and descent. But yeah, keeping the height calls up from the front seat to the back seat every 100 feet was really important. Now, we'd have the radar bug set to, and that's a low height warner set to 10% below. So if we're running in at 150 feet, it'd be set to 135. And one thing NAVS did not want to hear is the low height warner going off when they're looking in the radar scope, trying to find the target. You know, they need to have that warm and fuzzy that you are nice and stable at the running altitude and not doing anything that's going to, you know, endanger the crew.
Was there a lot of comm backwards and forwards between the cockpits to help keep a check on things?
There was a lot of comm, and I mean, we talked about terrain following radar. There was a lot of comm associated with that. I think, you know, when you were going back to, this ties in a lot of things like SA and things like that, because, you know, you could be talking over important radio comm, you know, SA building comm, AOX chatter or something like that, or threat calls or defending calls. And it's about, in terms of managing your personal capacity, I think also balancing the volumes on the CCS. So that's like your audio deck, balancing the volume between what's the radio, how loud's that going to be compared to the crewmate, compared to the RHWR, and prioritizing talking. So I think, I don't know if this is unfair on the single seat guys, but you know, they've just got themselves, they've got this nice quiet cockpit. But there was a lot of comm that was required in the tornado. So addressing your question directly about the range is that, the navigator had a radar readout on their TV screen. And it wasn't until the GR4 that they had a HUD repeater through the forward-looking infrared, but they had a radar readout. So I'd be coming down 500, 400, 300. 200 and just count down, and you get a check from him that he's seen the same. And you can see also that your rate of descent would be good, because if you're not going down quick enough, 400, and you can become fixated on the radar, and we've got other stuff to do, like you need to be going into the attack mode of the radar or something like so. Having the right cadence to the descent was important, but then nobody likes to be below 500 feet going down like a train. You know, it needs to be controlled. It's expeditious but controlled. So, you know, that was one of the things that you got to know is, okay, if I set about this pitch angle or this rate of descent on the velocity vector in the head-up display, I get a sensible cadence of descent. So yeah, But before going into an attack mode, they would say, okay, selecting fixed attack. They might also patter out loud what their height sensor was going to be. And, you know, I think, allied to the communications and balancing essay, it's so important to keep it standard, keep it clear, concise, and relevant and timely. So, you know, all of those things enhance crew essay, I would say.
And did you get crewed with a student nav during the training process?
Yes. Yeah. Both Treble T and TwiQ courses had crew solos in there. Really great. It's great for building your confidence, and honestly, lovely to have a trip where, yes, you're going to have your tapes looked at, but you're with an oppo. Now, of course, there's the risk of tripping each other up. So I can remember not specifically on the Treble TE course, but on the weapons course at TwiQ, I had a crew lay loft trip. So they paired the lay down delivery, so that's a level delivery, and the loft deliveries. And that was the first kind of weaponeering phase you did. So you did several with an instructor and then went as a crew. And yeah, Julie, you know, he forgot a couple of switch selections, and maybe I, you know, buffooned some stuff as well. And yeah, we failed the trip, and he was an ex-Buccaneer navigator. So I kind of felt bad about that because he's a good guy, and I'm sure it's mostly me tripping us up, but that's the nature of it, you know, and that's what the crew solos were there for. If you're always flying with a crewmate that was on the money, you'd never be exposed to the mistakes that can be made. So in particular, like, for the loft attacks, you had to tell the airplane that you were doing that kind of attack. What that did was change the display. Instead of a time to overflight, so if you can imagine like a circle, which is a minute, a whole complete circle is a minute, resolved around the flight path vector in the head-up display, that's a minute to overflight. But if you tell it's a loft attack, you've already told the computer that you're going to be pulling up at 23 seconds to overfly or wherever it happens to be. And so the time to go is time to pull up and not time to overfly. So you can appreciate that if you're intending to do a loft attack but forget to tell the airplane that that's what you want to do, then you're going to fly straight over the target because the time to go is not reflecting where you need to be. And when the navigator made those selections, you got lights illuminated on the weapons control panel in the front seat. So that's one of the many ways we could trip each other up, but it encouraged the monitoring. And that's the point. You've got to do your own job, do it well, but have an eye for the switch selections your crewmate can make that you can monitor. And that if they're not made, that you can verbally intervene and say, hey, remember those buttons, please.
When you think about the fact that the Tornado IDS is a generation behind the F-15E, I suppose it shouldn't come as a surprise that it appears to be more difficult to operate and employ. I had the good fortune of being able to fly the GR1 sim many years ago when I was up at Lossy covering a story for one of the magazines. And I had a nav QY, who was my tour guide, effectively set me up in the sim, and so he was in the back and I was in the front, and he was setting up attacks.
Yep.
And I was looking at the symbology and it didn't seem intuitive at all, and quite different from the symbology when, you know, a few years later I was able to do the same thing again in the Strike Eagle sim. So I'm just wondering whether or not, you know, sort of differences in the pilot vehicle interface are a good illustration of the differences in generations between those two aircraft, and whether or not that's an accurate observation.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I would say the Tornado is relatively straightforward to fly, difficult to fly well. So I would illustrate that by, again, you know, if you can imagine someone who's come from the Hawk, you might learn a G limit or something like that. You're not used to flying angle of attack, so now you've got to remember a G limit and an alpha limit. Now you've got wings that move, so you've got a speed limit in 25 wing. I can still remember them to this day for the training fit. It's 450 knots, and that's normal operating, and it was 500 knots, never exceed. But then you've got 45 wing, which was 550. I think it had 570, never exceed. And then you got 67 wing, and that had I didn't really I had the just the airframe limit for the speed. But if you went into, like, obviously a lot of your previous interviewees done BFM and stuff like that, and I know you're very familiar with the term. So if I'm hitting a merge in the tornado and BFM, I would be merging at about 0.8, 45 wing initially. So the G limit I can use in a training fit, generally speaking, it would be generally 4G. If I'm less than 4 tons, I could pull 5G. But I can only use 17 alpha. So I hit the merge, and I go into my rate term with the burners in. I pull to the G limit. The alpha starts to build. I select the wings forward, and the aircraft kind of would tuck into the turn at that point. And then I'm looking to go right to my G limit. As long as that is no more than 17 units, then I'm going to hit 17 units. And then if the speed gets below 350, I can then go to 21 units. So the goalposts are moving the whole time, and the airplane is doing nothing to stop you from overstressing. So I think the key thing is muscle memory, practice, to develop the muscle memory for what the G limit feels like. And you could get good at that. But the thing is that the fit we were training is very much like the one that's behind you now. But if you were in a merge with somebody, you would have punched the tanks off, and that would leave you with the sky shadow pod that's shown on the aircraft's left wing behind you, and the Boss chaff and flare pod. And that's just not a fit we would fly in very often. So, you never really got the chance to build that muscle memory. And of course, if you're staring in the head-up display trying to nail these parameters, you're going to lose sight and lose the fight. Compare that with the F3 guys. Now, obviously, I didn't fly the F3, but what I did see is that quite often they would train with that aircraft in what I think they call kilo fit, clean. So no tanks. That is the fit they would commit in. So obviously the aircraft would be heavier with the Sky Flash or the AMRAAM and the ASRAAM or Nilemas. Yeah, but basically the fit would be as it is that they're training in every day. So that I understand they, had a 19 unit arm. So that was their best alpha. And they got very good at nailing that. But the Tornado was, that's the summary of it. Complex, lots of different limitations, NONE, three wing sweeps. If you start putting different stores underneath the aircraft, that would make a difference. Underfuse large stores would limit the alpha. It's not easy. And when you add to that, if you get slow and say a flat scissors or something like that, the alpha unit was 21, which is nothing compared to a Hornet or anything like that. But it was a full two hands worth on the stick to sustain that. Now that was down to what the Tornado had fitted called the SPILS, the spin prevention and incidence limiting system. And it basically was discouraging you from being in that regime, reversing, adverse yaw, et cetera, with high angle of attack. So it was trying to make it hard work for you. As part of the pilot check, what we did was let's get back to 21 units. Like, let's do some reversals. Generally got a best roll response from unloading a bit, a quick dab of rudder to get the reversal in. And then you could use the reversal. You were reversing using the stick, so you had the spoilers working for you. And then when you've got the angle of bank that you want to turn back towards the opponent, then get the load back on. If you switch the spills off, and we would do this to kind of illustrate this is what it's going to feel like if you have a failure, the stick was a lot further forward. The stick load was a lot lighter. And I just think it would have been a lot easier to fly accurately at that stick load. So as I say, I never flew the F3, but I understand. So test pilots on fixed wing test at Boscombe Down flew both types. And I understand that the F3 stick load was a lot lighter than the GR. I've heard stories that the Italians wanted the GR in the high alpha environment to feel like an F104. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly sounds about right, because it was heavy. And I just think it would have been better. And it never changed. This is hardware stuff, like control stuff, which never changed. I think it would have been, if I could have changed some stuff, then I would have changed the stick loads in the the high alpha regime so that you could fly at one arm. Maybe it's a damning indictment on the size of my biceps, I'm not sure. But if you could fly it, you fly it one-handed, precisely without, worrying about being ham-fisted. I mean, it didn't bite. If you over alphaed, you sort of have to tell the engineers, and they'd have to do some checks, and that's a bit embarrassing, and it usually involved a crate of beer for adding to their workload unnecessarily. But I think you had to be going well off the clock before the vortices off the fuselage could interfere with the top of the fin, I think, and then set up a violent oscillation. I think there might have been fin tips snapped off, but I think that's, if it goes radically out of shape.
So the implication of an over alpha is turbulent airflow over the fin.
I think so for the tornado, yes. I've heard on some of your other presentations and the other YouTube stuff, if you're fighting for real, you need to cheat, lie, whatever you need to do to win. And I just think perhaps, I would have considered turning the spills off, but you can't really train for that, because you're risking departure or, using mid-flap, stuff like that. You can't fire a sidewinder through it, but if you're needing it, you need to stay alive just long enough for your mate to come in and help you. If you're in a flat scissors or rolling scissors with somebody more agile, then it might be what you need to do. And certainly the best pilots that I've heard interviewed flying the F-14 or any of those other platforms, they knew ways of cheating. They went off and did it. And that in terms of our fleet culture, that didn't happen. We were good. We as in that we did what we were supposed to in terms of the spills. There was one accident attributed to a guy being a bounce pilot, and he had the spill switched off. He was Italian, and his nickname became Spinelli after that, because he departed the aircraft and they had to eject. I think he had a third tank under the fuselage, and he was high and maybe a bit slow over the top of the formation that he was trying to intercept. And he did a couple of reversals, and this spin prevention system wasn't on, so that led to departure and injection. So.
Yeah, let's stay with this topic while we're here. So the Tornado IDS in the air-to-air arena, and I think no one's going to make any misrepresentations about it being an air-to-air fighter, but I am curious to know what your plan was if you got bounced and whether or not there were any real-world threats that you thought you had enough parity with that you could maybe turn and burn with them, and just generally how you'd respond to a bounce in the real-world scenario.
Low-level evasion was typically used as a formation control tool. So the tactics that were first taught in the conversion unit were this kind of parallel fuselage evasion. So when one turns, they both turn. Now that was on egress from the target, so you've dropped the weapons and you could afford to be more aggressive. Ingressing the target with the weapons load, clearly, the opposition achieves a mission kill if they force you to jettison your weapons. So generally, the ingress tactics would be to widen the split, to use 100-foot flying and below terrain masking to then disappear, effectively forcing the fighter to commit to one target. If we were carrying retarded bombs, then the kind of option we discussed in brief was called bomb in the face. It's not unique to the Tornado. I think the Jaguars had it, and any mud moving platform would have considered using it. But for a fighter that's in your six, the idea would be to select a target of opportunity, make sure that you've decremented the weapons package. So the weapons package is what you've told the computer you want to drop and at what interval. So if you're attacking a target, you might have four or five bombs going off at this certain meter spacing between the bombs. But to just drop one bomb in the face, you'd have a pre-selected weapons package which would achieve just that. So you'd go into a target of opportunity mode, make this last of the switches light the late arm, and then pick all the bomb off. So the theory was obviously that the fighter, if he was smart, would see something coming off. He'd see the parachute of the bomb opening and go, "This is not good," and disengage. If he fails to do that, then he gets a face full of frag, and the fragmentation is something all MUD moves have had to, in low level attacks that involve target overflight, have had to honor, since time immemorial. And we would plan our targets to achieve the separation that used to reduce that risk to a given level. But of course, if you're like a couple of miles in the six, if you're not in the weapons engagement zone, then getting a bomb in the face is going to be hazardous to the health.
So were you expecting a tracking gunshot? And how long would the frag have stayed in the air for?
Yeah. You know what? I don't recall any specific parameters. Roughly, I think a couple of miles in the six, the weapon needs time of flight to come off to arm and to detonate. Obviously, it depends on the fusing that you had on the weapon at the time for the target, which generally would have been a fairly short delay, so it would have gone off. But as to, yeah, I mean, if he's really close, then I don't know if it would, if you'd have to ask a dyed-in-the-wool air defender if it would have put him off, seeing a bomb come off, because I guess he doesn't know. It depends on his risk factor as well. So, yeah, well, guns kill would be so glorious if I get this. But then you stay in for just a little bit too long and you get the bomb in the face. It's not going to be good. So my understanding of air defense tactics, at least, would be risk factor would be a fairly major thing. If they're close to a high value asset, maybe they'd stick with it. But it was just one of the tools in our toolbox. I think more of a deterrence than anything else. But to return to the egress, yeah, we were generally aiming to sandwich the bandit if he rolled in behind one of the pair to turn towards the threatened man. We were flying with nine lemurs, so we did have an all aspect capability to engage them as we came towards nose pointing, obviously honoring the presence of our wingman. If the threat was not targeting us directly, we would probably, given that most people would outmaneuver us, aim to try and kick around them. So an in-place turn, duck to ultra low level, try and use the camouflage to blend in. But yeah, I mean, in my time on the Tornado, the evasion tactics that we the training that we did mostly was at low level, and that was certainly an environment we felt comfortable in. Obviously, it's more difficult. I think dyed-in-the-wool fighter pilots probably don't spend any more time at low level than they absolutely have to. Perhaps you lose your SA, you lose comms with AWACS, or certainly other there are other considerations. But we felt comfortable down there. But I certainly think to survive against the Gen 4 threat, the Tornado would have needed to do the sort of stuff rather than everyone going two circle. We'd need to make life as difficult as possible for the opponent, especially if it's a single pilot opponent. We just need to work on the man as much as on the platform. So by that, maybe one jet stays low, one goes vertical, and try and drag the fight single circle. But this starts to become a quite high risk, not only with training but in operations with high rates of descent, trying to keep tally visual. But I think to survive against the MiG-29 or something like that, it would need to be that aggressive. We did practice those high to low transitions, but I don't recall the appetite being there for kind of doing this. One guy goes single circle, one goes two circle. It's really hard to keep your SA up, miss the ground, and employ those tactics. And I guess we felt that, generally speaking, we'd be operating with sweep and maybe detached escort as well. And that leak of threat would be probably either lead to a retrograde or a long range beyond visual range maneuver to try and sidestep him.
Yeah, that QI that I was talking about, Lossie, I asked him the same question, and he said that the plan would have been generally to have done a 180, and the threat would then have eaten a face full of AMRAAM, because generally speaking, anywhere he was going to go, there would be an escort of Eagles flying behind
Yeah.
him.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. That's the way to go. I mean, it's hard to overstate really that the aircraft was a high wing loader, high bypass engines, and with the burners in at low level, it was good. Certainly running in a straight line, it accelerate well, but in terms of turning, like everyone could outturn us pretty much. You can't. So I can't outrate somebody. Outradius, well, it's planting your flag, and with a limited ability to disengage and run, especially with modern weapon systems. So we were, to be fair, depending on fighter protection. I think that potentially there could have been a change with ASRAM being fitted. I did get a chance to fly with ASRAM training rounds. Great weapon, obviously still in service, and our integration was very basics, and I can't go into obviously any of the seeker head stuff, not that I can remember much anyway. But it was just a great weapon. I think in the end, it would force an opponent to have to honor the potential wares. And I think that would have made us a more difficult proposition. Obviously, the corollary of that is that with the weapon going much further, our shot discipline would have had to be exemplary. You know, so whilst you can get a radar lock, it wasn't a great radar for air-to-air, but it could, with a bit of AWACS queuing, get you a radar lock. But, you know, there's no interrogation. You'd need off-board declarations to say in all this kind of aspects which are second nature to a pure fighter pilot, like clear field of fire, what's beyond, you know, that would have been something we would have needed to train to a lot more. But if we'd had a helmet mounted queuing system particular for the missile, I think we could have offset the platform's limitations in terms of turn rate and such like.
So forgive the cheesy question then, but did the GR have any kind of secret weapon up its sleeve that it could have used in a real world scenario when bounced by a threat? So, you know, any kind of fancy electronic attack capability that it could have used to maybe shut down the threat's ability to target you?
So the EW suite was really tailored to surface threats. So the short answer is no. We did have a decent amount of chaff, so that could be used. I think our main tactic would have been to take it low level, because we're very good at that. Now, of course, the first Gulf War showed barrage AAA can be a major threat and you're going to lose people, but that's generally over target areas, maybe. So I think if I had been engaged and, you know, obviously we'd do the retrograde that the QINO was talking about, but if it came to it, split and then head for the deck, clear the aircraft off. And the benefits there is that, you know, potentially out of enemy air, IAD's radar coverage, forcing the guy to use his own radar. You know, does he want to be in the radar scope in the low-level environment? Maybe not. It depends. If he's got AWACS as well, then obviously there's other considerations. But, yeah, well, you know, it's an aircraft that needs force protection. And in all the operations I did, we certainly had that. If it was OCA from F-15 Charlies, you know, force protection, straight seed from the CJs, jamming protection, we had all of that stuff. And you know, that was really, I saw that in the no flows fly zone patrols I did between the Gulf Wars from sort of 98 to 2000. That was the kind of package we were generally operating.
Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.